Hello and welcome to the program. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, a full house tonight. Aina Nilana is here. Niall Hatch is here, both in studio. Richard Collins at his home in Malahide. And I think Terry's coming in tonight. He'll be in with us shortly to tell us all about wonderful news received by the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin during the week. Apparently, it has been voted the number one botanical gardens in Europe. Did you know that, Aina? Have you heard about this?
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. It's a great place. I love going to the Bots and have always loved going to the Bots, in fact. And they probably are doing loads of things all this week as well for National Heritage Week, because it's National Heritage Week.
It is National Heritage Week, and you're going to be out and about.
I am going to be out and about. In fact, I'm hardly going to be at home at all. I'm starting on Wednesday and Thursday. I'm down in various metropolises in County Meath, six of them to be precise, Askalgan, Rathcarn, Wailagaquadella, and talking about wild and wonderful wildlife things to various audiences of children. And then on Friday at 3 o'clock, I will be leading a walk in JFK Park in New Ross, which is the Arboretum down there. And anytime I've been down there this year, it's been a lashing rain. And of course, the weather forecast for Friday is Hurricane Ernesto. So it would be dreadful if
it's Ernesto, is that what it's called?
Oh yeah, Ernesto, it's coming. It hasn't arrived yet, but it'll be there by then, don't you know? And then on Saturday, then I am going to Drumiskin to your good friend Mary Murtha, who at the opening Drumiskin pond, it was a lovely quarry that they filled up with water, and they got access eventually to get to parochial grounds. So a great occasion, and they wanted somebody famous to come and open it, but they couldn't get anyone, so they asked me. So I'm going down to open that. And then on
not like you to be such a shrinking violet.
And then on Sunday, if we haven't had enough water, it's Water Heritage Day, and I'm going down to Greig na Mana, where we'll have a walk along the River Barrow. I will end up by having my annual swim in the River Barrow, like I always do on the last Sunday in August. So apart from that, I'm not doing much really next week.
And you were at the zoo during the week. I believe you bumped into Richard Collins.
Well, not physically, but I did meet him in the Meerkat restaurant, and I had my grandson and my husband, and they were rushing off to gaze at the meerkats, and Richard was looking for his son and the visitors the son had brought, and everybody was moidered. But we weren't too moidered. We were able to talk to each other. I had a great chat with him. It's great to see him again.
Are you a fan of meerkats, Rich?
I am indeed, and the media has done great work for the little meerkat. The meerkat was completely unknown until that famous documentary by David Attenborough, Meerkats United. After that, the meerkat's profile was extraordinary. It's a marvellous example of what public relations can do. It really is. It's a beautiful little animal and a curious little animal. It's a little mongoose. I'm sure everybody knows it. Anyone who's been to the zoo, so I don't have to describe it. But it is a marvellous little animal, a most interesting little animal, very humanoid. That binocular vision, that upright stance, that constant vigilance, and it's lovely.
You think it was David Attenborough that made them famous and not the ad for insurance that's constantly on the television, Rich?
But was that there before the famous programme, Meerkats United?
Well, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I think the meerkat came first. This little mongoose of the deserts of southern Africa. I mean, nobody had come across it much. It's the kind of place I've been there in these deserts, and I look for meerkats. I must admit, I never found them, but that's because I wasn't there long enough and wasn't good enough to find them. But anyway, that sort of place, it doesn't impinge on world consciousness much until somebody like David Attenborough comes along and makes a programme about an endearing little animal there. I mean, the sidewinder snake is there, a very interesting animal, and there are various beetles and things that trap the dew in the morning and that kind of thing. But the meerkat scored. He's now a celebrity.
Niall.
I think it is that that human-like appearance that they have, the way that they'll stand up on their back legs or on their haunches at least, and they have that very expressive, cute-looking face. They live in social groups. The little young are so cute as well, and they seem to have these wonderful family relationships. And I think it is, yeah, I think that people fell in love with them because of David Attenborough. And
what happened in a restaurant in the zoo? I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, the thing is, I remember once, I've seen them in the restaurant there in Dublin Zoo or on the outside of the window of it, and it is fantastic to get up close and personal with them like that. But I had an even closer experience once. I remember being in the city of Seoul in South Korea, and they had
a meerkat.
Well, indeed. And they had a meerkat cafe there where you can go in, you have your tea and coffee and muffins, whatever you want, but they literally have meerkats just running around and they can climb on people.
Serving you. No,
well,
no,
not serving you. They're kind of doing their own thing, and they have sort of maybe a sort of slightly healthy disdain for people. You know, they're not, you know, they weren't frightened by people, but they wouldn't necessarily give them much at the time of day. But if you had a little cricket or something in your hand, they'd run up and take it
from you. But they wouldn't want a bit of your bun. They knew not to eat.
No, they seem to be mainly meat.
And also, I mean, when you're in the zoo, they all go underground a lot, and you only some of them up. So in the restaurant in Seoul, was there holes for them to go underground, or was they up there?
Yes, as far as I could see, they did have little tunnels, and they had also little cloth runs and towels and things that they would go underneath. It was interesting to see it. So obviously it's a bit of a tourist trap, tourist attraction. I find that strange, actually, in some parts of East Asia, like also in, you know, Korea and also in Japan, you have these pet cafes. Started with, I think, cat cafes in Japan, and then there's owl cafes. People have this, people looking for connection with animals and with nature. I know in Japan, at least, because traditionally in Tokyo, the apartments where people live are so small, they don't have room for pet. So a lot of people, their only interaction with animals is through these cafes.
Ah, but some are more equal than others. There's places in Ireland getting closed down because the things running around aren't cute little meerkats.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
There are other four-legged creatures instead, which are not so welcome. So, but I mean, surely the hygiene problems aren't the same. Well, I know rats are worse than meerkats, but still they're all animals, and they may or may not excrete, they may or may not have germs attached to them, they may or may not urinate. I don't know whether I'd want a meerkat running around my restaurant, thank you very much.
I'm not sure if it'd be legal here in Ireland. I suppose that if you're going to this meerkat cafe in Korea, you know what you're getting yourself in for. You're kind of signing up or consenting to it, I guess. One of the things I love about meerkats too, it's the name. Like, as Richard mentioned, they're in the mongoose family, even though they look more endearing than many of the other mongooses would be, more human-like. But the name is brilliant. It comes, I believe, from the Afrikaans. When European settlers were first in southern Africa, they saw these creatures and they're wondering, what on earth are these? And they look more cat than dog. And in Afrikaans, meerkat als hund. So that's where meerkat.
But it's not spelled C-A-T, it's K-A-T.
N-E-E-R-K-A-T.
And of course, in Dublin Zoo, the meerkats are completely separated from the restaurant. There's a huge big glass wall, so there's no question of them being in the restaurant, in case somebody listening hasn't actually been there to see it. But the children do love it, and they love them. Yeah, they do. It's great.
But gorgeous little animals. I'm not surprised they're so popular. But I think, as you said, Derek, I think it is that insurance ad.
Yeah, I've just checked. Meerkats United, which Richard mentioned, David Attenborough's documentary, was made in 1994. But 2009 was when the meerkat ads for insurance first aired.
They have Russian accents in it for some reason, which is baffling too.
Well, but do meerkats not have Russian accents? Anyway, I noticed something during the week which I thought I'd bring to your attention. I was in Ballsbridge, and just near Ballsbridge there's a hotel, and in front of the hotel there is little gardens, and it has box hedging all around the perimeter. And I noticed a wood pigeon walking on the box hedge. Now, probably no big deal, but I've never seen a bird walking on hedge before in my life. I've seen birds perched on branches, etc., etc. But this one was actually walking. And I whipped out the phone. And of course, by the time I got my phone out, it actually flew away. But I got me wondering all about pigeons and how they walk and all that kind of stuff.
It was a wood pigeon, I take it.
Wood pigeon, yeah absolutely. Yeah.
They walk in my back garden as well. I have a pyracantha bush. And the pyracantha bush is covered in flowers in summertime and the bees are there. But in the autumn time, it's covered in berries. And the wood pigeons walk on the hedge. They don't sort of like a tightrope walker. I mean, they land on the hedge. They find some class of a bit of the hedge to land on. And then they nude over and then they walk another step and they do. But they're not like walking in a straight line because it's a good bush.
No, and
they
can do that. Very dense.
But that's in the autumn. But what I noticed recently was, I was looking at me elder tree. I have an elder tree as well in the back garden. Wonderful plant collection. And the leaves on the top of the tree were like lace. They were shredded to bits. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what has been eating me leaves way up on the top of the tree? What class of a caterpillar? I must send a note into that woman in the Irish Times and ask her. But as I watched and listened, it was actually the pigeons. They had come down, landed on the top of the tree and shredded the leaves to bits. They weren't eating berries. They were actually eating the leaves. Berries are on there now and they're hanging upside down trying to get the berries, because when the berries are ripe, they hang down. But they walk from branch to branch. And I suppose on trees, the branches are further and they get more to eat. Probably on your hedge, Derek, because it was a mouthful at a time. They had to keep going.
But it was the walking. It was the walking.
I mean, if you think when you normally see a bird perched in a bush or in a tree, it's one of, usually a songbird. And think about like a blackbird or a song thrush or something like that. And most of those, when you see them walking on the ground, they don't really walk the way that we do, one foot in front of the other. They tend to hop along. And it's thought that this is an adaptation, that their legs are coordinated and synchronized. It makes them very good at gripping onto things in trees. Now, there are other songbirds, like crows, for example, which are a type of songbird. They do habitually walk one foot in front of the other like we do. Wagtails, another good example of that too. But pigeons are different. They're not closely related to those other birds at all, and in all around the world, they really do specialise in feeding on foliage. They eat fruits as well, maybe grain, all of these things. But pigeons, as a group, are very well adapted to feeding on leaves, which is something that not many birds really do in a European context, other than the pigeons. There's a few that do it to a small degree, but nothing like the pigeons do. And if you go to the tropics, then where obviously you have a huge variety of different plants and different leaves, you'll see many different species of pigeon that feed on those. And many of those species of pigeon have evolved to be brilliant green in colour. So they're camouflaged when they're doing that, and they're feeding up in the canopies of the trees. So that's what pigeons do. They eat fruit, they eat leaves, and they're very good at doing it. And they have a special digestive system that allows them to get the maximum nutrition from this, because it's not the most nutritious food. I mean, Derek, imagine if you ate nothing but, let's say, lettuce for a week. You wouldn't be feeling too good after, because there's not a huge amount of nutrition in that. You need to eat a huge quantity of that to be able to get enough nutrition, or to extract, or have a special digestive system that will allow it to extract the nutrition into your body. And so pigeons have become very good at clambering around in trees. And that's probably what you're saying.
That's exactly the word. It wasn't walking, it was clambering.
Yes, and they'll grip at one foot and then they'll loosen the grip on the other foot and clamber around. And most birds can't do that. But the pigeons' feet are much better gripping on while they walk than with other birds.
That's very interesting. I think the factor here is security. If you were a pigeon, pigeons are vulnerable. They're on the ground feeding normally on cereals and seeds and things like that. And usually the grass around them is fairly high. They have to be careful because the predator will get them. But if there's a nice hedge that you can walk along and you have a fine vista all around, you don't have to worry so much, at least not about ground predators anyway. And you'll notice an interesting thing about pigeon walking is that the head bobs back and forth. Now, that is about a distance measurement. And we don't have that sense because we have binocular vision. And when we look at something, we have two independent fixes on it. Your left eye sees a slightly different thing to what your right eye sees. And your brain, mysteriously and extraordinarily, synthesizes the two images into one. So you see what you think is one image, but it's actually two amalgamated. Now, in the case of something like a pigeon, pigeons see out one totally different image on the right side. They're looking to the right completely than they do to the left. So they have two totally different images. Now, how they deal with having consciousness of two completely different images at the same time is a total mystery. But what they lack then is the two images coming from the danger zone. If you're standing there and there's a predator, you want to be able to judge how far that predator is away. We can do it by the parallax, the angle between the two signals coming to our eyes, but the poor old pigeon can't. He has to bob the head, so he gets his two fixes by moving and moving constantly. And it's not peculiar to pigeons. All kinds of things are like that. Any animal that has a vision on one side only must bob the head. Water hens, you can see them as they swim. They are the bobbing, bobbing, bobbing all the time. And this is motion parallax is the term that's used. It's getting different fixes of distance so that it can tell whether there is a danger there, whether I'm likely to be attacked. In other words, how far away is the fox? How far away is the fellow with the gun? That sort of thing. So it's an extraordinary, and I think they do that. It's not just confined to sight. It may have to do with hearing as well. Remember, you judge where a sound is coming from and how far away the sound is by the difference in the sound between your ears. You're getting two sounds. You're getting one in left ear, one in the right ear, and you have to make sense of it. And from that, you can tell a great deal, and people turn their heads. We turn our heads to get a better idea of the sound. Even smell is rather similar. If there's a smell, where's that smell coming from? You sniff this way and sniff that way. Or something like a snake, for instance, the forked tongue of the snake. It's thought, nobody's sure, of course, but the two tips of the forked tongue register different signals from pheromones and from heat from an animal in front, and they can judge the distance better. But I think that's what's going on here, and I think the pigeon up on top of the hedge is measuring distance all the time by bobbing the head.
Clambering, Niall, I just looked it up. Okay, yeah. Because it's a word I haven't heard for donkeys. I can't remember the last time. It's like haberdashery. When is the last time you heard the word haberdashery? Ain't looking at me.
Yeah, because below in Kilrush, where I go regularly, there's haberdashery shops. Haberdashery is a great word, isn't it?
Actually.
And Vittler's. Vittler's are another one. There's great shop names, actually, and mongers, fishmongers and haberdasheries and Vittler's. They were all names for shops long ago that we don't use now, and yet we know what they mean when nobody mentions them.
Anyway, clamber, climb or move in an awkward and laborious way, typically using both hands and feet. That sums up the way the pigeon was moving across that box hedge. I have to say. Apparently, box hedge has been around for thousands of years. The Romans were very fond of it. Did you know that, Richard?
Well, the Romans are an interesting lot. You know, living on larks' tongues and things of this kind.
They ate them.
But they ate them. Yeah, they didn't live on them. That's true, Anna. You're right. But they ate all kinds of things we'd never eat. You know, it's I don't think I would enjoy an ancient Roman restaurant.
The box hedge is in danger at the moment because we have a new box hedge moth that has become established in Ireland, and it's eaten the box hedges. Caterpillars have eaten the box hedges. I was buttonholed by Eric Burton, a former DD in the old days. He's one of my neighbours, and he has a box hedge, and it's been gobbled by the caterpillars of the box hedge moth, which is a black and white moth. He has a trap in the tree he got online somewhere with ferones in it, and all these male moths were going into the thing. He had a big box of the moths, and the caterpillars were gobbling his hedge, and that's only come into the country in the last 2 years. Oh. So the box hedge, the pigeon better hurry up and gobble its food because they may not be any longer with us. It's an invasive species.
We'll have to talk to Eric Dempsey about that. Yeah. He's making a documentary about moths. Anyway, let's move on. Now, I want to talk to you about a story that appeared on the news and on RTE.ie. It was about hundreds of natterjack toads which have been released in County Kerry in what is a first for Ireland's newest national park, Park na Síonta na Mara. 1,000 natterjacks have been bred in Dingle Ocean World Aquarium in a volunteer breeding programme in conjunction with the National Parks and Wildlife Service. 500 toadlets, they're called, were released into the dunes at Inch Peninsula in Dingle in County Kerry, which are now state-owned as part of Park na Síonta na Mara. Now, we have been following the story of natterjack toads for a very long time here on RTE Radio. In fact, one of the very first programmes I worked on with my late colleague, the great Dick Warner, was a documentary about natterjack toads on the Maharees Peninsula.
He's a bit smaller than a full-grown frog, just That's a tiny nice. Bit, I suppose, and with this brown warty skin and a very pronounced yellowish green stripe all the way down the back, and underneath is this lovely sort of speckledy grey and white colour, and with these fantastic hands, and he doesn't move at all like a frog. Just put him down for a second and let's see what he does. Oh yeah,
they're more gainly looking.
Yeah, I think they're great.
Yeah.
A wonderful sound of natterjack toads. And before that, you heard Dick Warner, who was the original producer of Mooney Goes Wild. We're going to say hello now to Kevin Flannery, who's the founder of Dingle Ocean World Aquarium. And you might be wondering what they have to do with natterjack toads. Well, he'll tell us all about it. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Derek. Hi, folks. How are you all doing? Basically, Derek, what it was is MPWS, Dr. Ferdy Marnell, contacted us, and we've been doing this for a number of years, is that basically some of the ponds that would be in the Inch, Castlemaine area in Maharees, they dry out. Not this year, but every other year they dry out. But also the survival rate of the tadpoles and the tadpole eggs in the ponds in these specific areas where the toads are. And they ask us, could we help out? And what we do is the MPWS, Wildlife Rangers, they transfer the tadpoles back to us, and we hold them in what we have a hatchery as such. and we help them. We grow them on until they're ready for release, and then NPWS come and they take them and release them back in after a few months. But in the meantime, it involves a lot of work, a lot of care and a lot of maintenance, because, as I said, the survival rate in the wild for the natterjacks is, out of each one of the rows of eggs that they lay, is very, very small, 1 or 2%, maybe 3% out of every couple of thousand.
Now, can you describe a natterjack toad for us? It's different to the common frog that we have in Ireland, and it's Ireland's only toad. How did it get here? How is it doing? Why do we have to make such efforts to make sure it survives?
It is vital because it's the only toad, as you say, we have, and it's totally different from your frog, and it's got this yellow line down its back. And as the great late Dick Warner was saying there, down when he was down in Mahari's doing the programme with you, you can see the difference. But they were virtually under threat because, of course, intensive farming that came with the advent of the EU and everything else. So it's vital that we preserve them. And especially now, we have to be very grateful to the government, because they now have bought Inch Island, and they've created the park tomorrow where hopefully now there'll be no more interference from land animals or domestic animals or anything else, and they will survive. How they came here is an interesting one I'd love to throw to Aina and your, because some people believe that they came, and my own thing would be there were probably Spanish vessels that were coming up here and trading, as we know, the huge trade in the southwest with Spain and still is, and they were possibly being used as a food source. I don't know. Or maybe they came as ballast and came ashore here in the Dingle Peninsula, and then they spread like that. But that's only my own assumption on how they came here. But I'd be interested to see what Richard or Ian would have to say on that. But as I say, it's so important that we preserve them and keep them here. And hopefully they'll expand out into the Inch Island area that has been bought by NPWS.
Yeah, do you good, Kevin? Going to start to Finn. Todd, I'm sure Jasok of Hiasin Shinnig, a bummer, and I will.
That's a good evening.
This is great work about the toad, and I see you're putting it to me, where do they come from? And when I started off in the Biological Record Centre way back in the 70s, and there was a fellow who discovered them in the first, or it was very funny, he was an English zoologist, and he wrote a paper about them, and he had discovered them. And should the people at Kerry said, sure, we knew they were there all the time. I mean, he was the first person who wrote about it in a scientific paper. But the people of Kerry have obviously always knew that they were there. But the biogeography people are saying lately that in fact they were here. They were part of our native fauna, that they didn't come in ballast, or they didn't come from Spain. They were actually part of a population or an area on the very west of the world, or of Europe, after the end of the last ice age, on land bridges. We have them just in Cornwall. We have them in Ireland. We have them in France and Spain. But just at the very tips of the peninsulas, that it wasn't that they were brought. That's all that's left of a population that was bigger than that. And more DNA analysis, presumably, will be able to show how long our ones are isolated from other ones in Spain and places like that. If they came up as ballast, I mean, the idea of ballast is not that there were so many toads that they kept the ship down, but that the sand that they would put into the holds to keep them steady was taken from the dunes beside where they were sailing from the beaches, and there might be toads and things shoveled in for good measure while they were at it. So the jury is still very much out, as far as I know, Kevin, on where they actually came from. But they certainly have made themselves at home there, and the habitat changes have been a huge problem. I remember Castlemaine Golf Course, when I was there in the 70s, had down beside their last fairway, they had natterjack toads, and then a seawall broke and the salt water came in. And salt water, they need freshwater ponds, not salt water, even though they're beside the sea. And to their everlasting credit, the golf course, I mean, and this was now in the 70s when, you know, wildlife were the enemy of golf courses because they kept golf courses from being developed and things. The Castlemaine Golf Course rebuilt their wall and they re-established those toads back there then. I wonder, are they still there in that, or did they succumb over the years? You don't know anything about that now, do you, Kevin?
They're still there. To the best of my knowledge, NPWS are keeping an eye on them all the time, and hopefully they're expanding. But as you say, back in the 70s, wildlife was the enemy of people in that sense, that they didn't want them there and they had a fear that they might interfere with whatever else they were doing, be it domesticating animals or playing golf or something else. And I know the same situation was down in the Maharees in the golf club area. And now they're a welcome visit to it and people are delighted to see them there. And in actual fact, they've expanded their range down there in the Maharees in the golf club and hopefully over in Dukes as well, over in the Cremon, that area over there. And with the help that we're giving them and with the help through Parks and Wildlife, though, we've put out, I'd say, over 2,500 of them this year, alive, well, and how would you say, hopping. So, and we were delighted to do that. We've been doing it since 2017. So I'm hopeful for their future. I am seriously hopeful for their future. If we can keep doing this, obviously Fort Island, they help out as well. They do a series of them. So between MPWS and ourselves and Fort, I think their future could be bright, and maybe they might extend, the population might spread outwards a bit more.
We must be doing something right after all in our 30 years of programming. But the thing you were saying about alive and hopping, the difference between frogs and toads, of course, is that frogs hop and toads don't. Toads walk, and the common toad that you see on the continent is actually, might look like a frog to begin with, but it walks away, it doesn't hop. But of course, the natterjack toads, being Kerry toads, they don't walk. They run. They actually run like little mice rather than actually walking like the big cumbersome toads that you get on the continent, which makes them even more endearing, I suppose, that they run around like this and they're brown with a yellow stripe down their back. So you couldn't possibly mistake them for a frog by any manner of means.
I know that when it comes to amphibians, but we in Ireland, we've been often seen as the poor relation in European context because we have so few species. We have three native species, including the natterjack toad. One of the concerns I know that's been rearing its head in recent years is the risk from non-native species being introduced or inadvertently or even deliberately released in Ireland. We've seen a species called the alpine newt appearing in the Midlands now, presumably being tipped out of aquariums and so on. Do you know, Kevin, is that something that's been watched for, that the problems that an invasive species could bring in? And I know particularly with amphibians, it's because of a fungal infection that can then spread and could, you know, potentially wipe out a population that's so fragile, like these natterjack toads in Kerry.
It is, Niall. And you know, the most worrying part about it is the free access and the access in of all these species that can be got so easily. I mean, in car boot sales virtually anywhere up around the north or through the UK, and they're being brought in, and very easily I have reason to believe there was some sort of a toad released into a lake up in Cavan, and that has expanded out, and it's a very worrying aspect now. And the big thing I think Parks and Wildlife have to get out there is to reinforce it to the public that, you know, you just can't buy these as domestic pets and you can't keep them in the house, because obviously the situation we have found, an interesting one, even with type of turtle that people believe they're buying, but they're not buying them, and they're releasing them back into the wild. We've had to collect hundreds of them. We had to give up actually collecting them when people were buying them, and Johnny was going off to college, and then Mammy and Daddy possibly dumped it somewhere, and people believed that, look, we're after finding a turtle, we're after finding a loggerhead, we're after finding this, and we find that they're just the ordinary common red sliders, and we've had to pick it up. And it's so easy to bring them into the country, and they're for sale, and there needs to be more restriction put in place, because, as you say, it will endanger through the various diseases and viruses that they can bring in.
I am actually often shocked about what is available for sale freely. You need a license to keep a dog in Ireland, but you don't need a license to keep all sorts of other much more exotic pets that are freely traded. I think, you know, given that we live on an island, we have a major advantage from other countries in that we can control this more easily. But it seems that these controls just don't happen. It's too easy for people to bring things in either legally or illegally. And then when you see a species that's so restricted like the natterjack toad, the great efforts that are going to save it, it would be tragic if just one person inadvertently caused the demise of that whole species. So I do think biosecurity is something we need to be a lot more mindful of in Ireland. And we're seeing, you know, invasive, as Aina was saying earlier, but this moth now that affects box hedges and so on. These things come in all the time, and we really should be doing a lot more to try and combat that.
Richard.
Kevin, could I ask you, it used to be said that the Natterjack toad in Kerry came from Britain. The nearest genetic match to our ones in Kerry, I think, comes from Lancashire. Now, it doesn't necessarily imply that our ones came from Lancashire. Maybe the Lancashire ones came from ours. But I'd like to ask you about the rearing of them in captivity. You had them in captivity. Now, from the days long ago when we used to keep frogs for the kids and the tadpoles would develop, the tadpoles used to eat each other at a certain stage. You know, you'd find that the number of tadpoles in the tank dropped with time. And what was happening, of course, there were cannibal tadpoles. Now, is that the case with natterjacks? Are you keeping them all together and do they get on or do they eat each other? Or what is the dynamic of raising natterjacks in captivity?
It's an interesting one, and you're actually right, Richard, and they are possibly cannibalistic and they will eat the tail of the thing, but they use it up. But what we do is we saturate them with food. We have given them the lettuce, but we give them blue-green algae, spirulina, which we had, and we feed them on that, and they thrive. And once they have plenty of that type of food to thrive on, they tend to stay away from one another. We do get a variation of sizes, because when we get them in, we'll say the very early end of April, start of May, they are in a stress state, because obviously something might have dried out or there might be that. But we have specialised tanks, and then we saturate them with food. They thrive on lettuce, they thrive on the spirulina, this blue-green algae. And now I see this blue-green algae has been in for sale in shops for people to take as a drink, and I've seen some astronauts are being given it because it has all the basic vitamins, the amino acids, everything else. But once they get enough of this, once you provide them with enough of food, they tend to stay away. So the returns we're getting, you know, the mortality rate is very, very small, provided you keep doing this. You'd be looking at 3-4% mortality rate, which has worked out very well for us. Now, it was obviously trial and error initially at the start, but the advent and the availability of the spirulina and just the right water temperatures, we have found that we are able to get a greater return for these onto the wild. We then transfer them once they lose the tail as such, once they use that up, the energy from their tail, and once they have grown their legs, we then move them on to another different part of the hatchery where they are fed on fruit flies, a type of fruit fly that we breed, and it's confined inside in these cases as such with them. And they thrive on these fruit flies, and it gets them used of the natural wild environment where they will have to capture their own insects. And we grow these on then to the next stage. And then once they're finished that stage, we transfer them back out into the wild. Well, it's MPWS, the wildlife officers, because we'd like to keep it confined, and they know exactly where to put them out and keep them away from the general public and the general beach area where people would be. But they go through these three different stages with us, Richard. And as I say, once we have found the proper type of food and algae that they thrive on, we are finding that the cannibalistic effort of them is reduced greatly once they have that type of food.
Well, how long does all that process take? I mean, it takes them a long time to breed. There's 2 or 3 years they stay on land and then they go into the ponds and that kind of thing. Now, did you have these things for years, months, or what?
No. In actual fact, we get them in around the end of April, depending on the condition of the ponds and, as I say, the weather and everything, depending. The wildlife rangers keep a very close eye on it, and they see how the ponds are doing and how the eggs are developing and if there's any danger to it. But even if there isn't, because what we have developed is this methodology. So let's say we get them in the end of April, the first weekend of May, and by mid-July to the end of July, we are able to release them back out into the wild. Now, they're at a very small stage, but you have to do that. Ongrowing them, which has been done by FOTA, is a different kettle of fish as such. You could keep them on, but our preference, and working with the MPWS, Dr. Ferdy Marnell, is grow enough of them and release them back into the wild at that stage when they're capable of fending for themselves.
And you have virgin ponds into which you can put them, in which there is no knackerjack present already. So you're able to measure how well it does. If you put them in with the others, the natives, presumably they lose out in competition, or maybe they don't. But you can tell what factors are leading to their success. But if you put them into virgin ponds, ponds in which there are no knackerjacks already, of course, you don't know how suitable those ponds are, but you have a good idea. It's a very interesting one from the point of view of the zoology of it to test that. Do they do as well or better than the ones raised in the wild?
It would be a very interesting question, but basically what we're trying to do at this point in time, because it was an emergency situation that brought it about when the ponds were drying out and the farmers had no, couldn't do nothing about it, basically. So they were all going, a year's load of tadpoles were going to die off. So basically when the situation arose, we jumped at the to help out NPWS and bring them in. And it's since that, and as you initially said about them devouring one another, if we hadn't learned this, the numbers we would be able to return to the wild would have been extremely low. But now that we're able to do this, I think further investigation could go on. We're doing this on a voluntary basis, you must understand, whereas I think it could be done maybe by some of the universities or something like that. Should look into it, Richard, what you're looking for. But our main point, and I think the point of the NPWS, is just to get and maintain the good breeding stock and to maintain these species here.
Well, if John O'Halloran in UCC is listening in, I'm sure he'll get one of his students to do the work. Anyway, go ahead, Niall.
Yeah, we've been talking, Kevin, about how the adult toads differ from frogs in their behaviour and their appearance. But one of the things I think is most distinctive and most interesting about the knackerjack toad is how different its eggs are. I'm sure many people listening to us will be very familiar with frog spawns, big mass of gelatinous eggs that you'll see in ponds and around the country at certain times of the year. But when it comes to knackerjack toads, their eggs are very different, aren't they?
They are, and they lay them along the bottom. But it's the big problem. Well, people will, let's hope that an awful lot of people wouldn't see them. I know the people in Maharees and all that know exactly, and they know the mating, because they would tell me, and some people say, oh my God, can we ever get to sleep because of the noise they create down there when they're mating, as Dick Warner's programme had shown there. But the egg masses are totally different than your ordinary frog spawn. But as I say, nobody should interfere with them, and NPWS thankfully now are keeping a greater watch on them to see where they are and the numbers that are there.
Yeah, absolutely, and people of course absolutely should not go anywhere near where these animals are suspected to be reproducing, and shouldn't interfere in any way. But the eggs themselves, they lay them in long strings or chains, don't they? They get wrapped around vegetation underneath the water rather than bobbing around near the surface in a big mass the way the frog's eggs would.
Yeah, you can see them under the water, and as you say, they're in a long chain in the bottom. But my preference is for nobody to go see them or looking at them, and that only the people who own the land or are adjacent to it should be at them, because some people have been collecting these and they think it's okay to collect stuff and take it in, like it was done years ago, as Ian would say, bring them into the classroom and every house virtually brought in frog spawn and they started hatching them out and doing this. But it's all getting so scarce in the wild that all that stuff should be left into the wild and leave it there.
Mind you, the frogs, I mean, the frogs are more abundant, the actual frogs, as opposed to the toads. I don't think anybody ever brought in knackerjack toad eggs into school, but you can still actually bring frog spawn into school, because the NPWS give a derogation every year from the EU directive. So, you know, that sometimes can happen in places where there's lots of frog spawn. So not to get those two things mixed up. Frogs are different to toads. These toads are particularly rare. They're only down in Kerry. I wanted to ask you though, Kevin, there was a part of the acre scheme or the GLOS scheme where the farmers were excavating ponds along the other side of the Dingle Peninsula, the south side of it. And if toads took up residence, they got extra payments. Did that work well, do you think, down that end? Yeah,
it did. It worked very well initially. But then again, like everything else, it's hard to believe that ponds do dry out. The wet summer that we're having even this year, but the ponds tend to dry out sometimes. And especially when you had intensive farming and the whole lot, and they were getting paid to do this. And this is where the MPWS people, the wildlife rangers, have been, and they keep a very close eye on these ponds. And then if they find that the ponds are drying out and the eggs are in danger of drying out, the whole lot, that's when they move them to both ourselves and to Forta straight away. And it was through these ponds that was initially drying out that we got the initial first batch. But now the situation had arose that there wasn't enough in reproduction, and I'd say we'll virtually have this every year going forward, that to help out and to increase the numbers in the wild, because they are under threat, and there was intensive farming took place in all them areas, and as I said, the ponds did dry out. So that's how initially we started out, and that's how MPWS came to us and we took them in then.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, NPWS, which we keep referring to, is the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Kevin, it's a terrific effort and well done to everybody concerned. Just before we leave you, how is Dingle Ocean World Aquarium doing? What are your numbers like? Are people still flocking?
People are still coming, Derek. What we do is we come up with something different. And you, as you know, fishermen, and especially with the iPhone and everything, they're still coming up with something different. And I thought this year, with the colder temperatures, the colder sea temperature, because I honestly think they're well down on last year from our intake. The temperatures are 4 or 5 degrees different than last year. But we still get different species. I got a species of comber, would you believe, a fisherman up on Donegal Bay, John Mayer of the Charlie Bay, and Eddie Moore here. They picked up which they thought was a cuckoo wrasse. This species is very like a cuckoo wrasse, but in actual fact it's a comber. And they have only been found up north to the English Channel. We very, very, very rarely get this type of fish coming into our waters. As well as that, we picked up deep water crayfish, white crayfish, which are Mauritanica, so they're basically African crayfish. And one of these was picked up northwest of the Blaskets. So there's still interesting stuff, but as I say, most of the stuff is coming from the southern region all the time, which obviously means that we have warming waters, and we are picking up and showing people and put them on display and trying to educate people on about the seas all the time.
Yeah, the comber. The comber is actually a Portuguese fish. They eat it, actually. It's one of the fish they eat. As you said, it's a bony thing, one of the perch family. But yeah, to be finding it up as far as the English Channel, but now to be getting it up in Donegal Bay, it really indicates the warming of the waters. And cod. Cod are a cold water fish. Are we in danger of the cod shoving on further north and losing our cod?
I would safely say they're gone, because what we have found when we had them in the aquarium, when we had them on display, once it goes over 16 degrees, the cod is gone. So look, there was a big cod fishery down off of Dunmore East one time. There was a big cod fishery, and I would safely say they have moved further north. It's proving the Markle, the Spanish research people have shown that there's a 45-kilometre movement every year virtually with Markle that go into their waters after spawning and down spawning off of there, and they're moving further north. There is, without a doubt, your usual cod now. I mean, if you go into any restaurant in Ireland, you'll now see the Ryanair fish, as I call a hake. Every person that has been down in Spain said, oh, we got fabulous fish down there. And now in Ireland, virtually in every restaurant, you'll get nothing else but hake for sale in there, because plenty of hake been landed into Ireland and it's been sold in every restaurant, and you won't see cod virtually on the menu at all.
Why did you call it the Ryanair fish? I hope that wasn't an insult. Don't want Michael O'Leary suing us in the courts or anything like that.
No, everybody's been down to Spain and they say, oh, we had fabulous fish. What they're eating down there is the fish that's caught off the Irish coast, the hake, and it's brought down to Spain and sold there. And now all of a sudden they come back and everybody is putting it on the menu, and every restaurant in Ireland virtually has hake on the menu.
Okay. So, listen, since Fungi disappeared, no sign of him a good few years now, has tourism been hit in the area, or does it matter? Are you still doing okay?
We're doing okay. We're doing very well, because we put on something different every year. We put on different species and different things. But what the fishermen and everybody is realising, they're seeing more whales. They have eco tours left, right and centre. In actual fact, the numbers going to sea in sea safaris and in visitor numbers has actually increased even since Fungi, that because the fishermen realised and the boat tours realised, look, take them out and show them the minkies, the humpbacks, the dolphins, the porpoises, all the seals, everything around the Blasket Islands. And people are getting greater value for money. Rather than looking for one dolphin, they're able to see all these different species. So hopefully...
Yeah, but come on, you must all miss Fungi.
Of course, Derek. I mean, he was part and parcel nearly of the family. Everybody you go out to the mouth of the harbour, you'd see him every day and he was there. But it's sad, but everything moves on and people now are looking forward to seeing the return of the humpback whales and the minke whales and all the different species.
Well, good luck to you, Kevin. Thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.
Talk to you again. Bye.
Bye.
There goes Kevin Flannery. And don't forget, if you find yourself in the Dingle area, you can go out on a sea safari or you can keep your feet dry and go in and visit the Dingle Ocean World Aquarium. Terry Flanagan has joined us in the studio now. Terry, talking about natterjack toads and rearing them in captivity there. You did a report for us from Photo Wildlife Park a number of years ago because they're also involved in this project.
That's right. Both you and I were down there. We were doing a programme.
Was I there?
You were as well. But you were off doing a different report, but you didn't get to see the natterjack toads, but I did. I was with John McLaughlin and it was great to see it because they were rearing them there, thousands of them, bringing them back and releasing them. I think it's a great idea because before that too, I remember many, many years ago going down with Ferdy Marnell. It was must have been June just to see them mating and that. And like Aina was saying earlier on, the eggs, they're different because they appear in strings. And they're a lovely animal. And just to see them with that yellow stripe down their back, so different from frogs.
Anyway, you're in to talk about the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. Cadhain an Scéal.
Well, one of my favourite places to visit. It's not so long since I was there. But this week, they were voted the best botanic gardens in Europe. Isn't that an...
By who, Terry?
By an organisation called Accord. They're a French hospitality organisation. And the award is based on things like Google reviews and amenities and the price and the experience. And even if you look at the Google reviews, they got 4.8. There was nobody else in the competition that got a review as high as that. So I thought, well, I must go up and congratulate Dr. Matthew Jebb.
But did you speak to any people in the park?
I did, yeah. I spoke to them. Oh, of course I did. I got their views, first of all. I asked them, did they even know that it had won an award? So let's have a listen.
No, that's news to me. I'm delighted. Well deserved. It's just stunning.
I can well see why it would have. It's very underrated, I think. But it's great to see now. It seems to be part of the tourist trail now. But to have free access is just, it's unbelievable.
I didn't know that, but I'm not a bit surprised. Not one bit surprised.
Why did you visit today?
So we were just passing by and couldn't pass up the opportunity to go in for a little stroll.
We are locals and we were passing and we regularly come in here. So just, we couldn't pass without coming in.
Well, this is a regular place for us to come. It's on our kind of loop that we do. We live fairly locally and we consider this to be part of our garden.
We just love every aspect of it. We go different directions, come in and go one direction through Wild Ireland, or another day we'd come and go down by the lake, the river. It's just wonderful. There's so much to see. We're only up the road in Drumcondra, so it's just on our doorstep.
This is maybe my sixth visit here, so each time when I'm in Dublin I'm trying to come here because I love it, because it's very vibrant. You have different species of the plants. And I love the greenhouses, they're amazing.
Do you have a favourite plant?
I love all the hot lips. I think they're a wonderful display. We have them at home. Like, we wouldn't know the names of all of them, but we have some of everything here because we've seen flowers. We said we must get something like that for our garden.
I love them all. I love the perennials. Very well established here, especially this part of the garden, yeah.
Beautiful sunny day, or mostly sunny day. Yeah. And I want to take my mum out and give her a chance to see the flowers. She loves flowers and this was a chance to get out in the garden and, you know, take them all in.
My mother loved it and it reminds me of her. She came here every day and used to have her paper because she went to church there at the pyramid and used to come around on a Sunday and read her paper on her own, and she said, I never felt alone, and that was wonderful.
Well, that was just what some of the visitors to the park thought when I was there during the week. But really, the award is down to Dr. Matthew Jebb and all of the staff in the gardens because they all work so hard there and it is a fantastic place. And well done, Matthew.
Terry, come over here.
Oh, I see you. Matthew, I believe congratulations are in order.
Terry, you're very good. Yes, we had an unexpected win the other day when we were voted the best botanic gardens in Europe.
What type of person comes to the gardens here?
Well, the wonderful thing about a botanic gardens is it's suitable for everybody, from tiny toddlers getting that experience of wandering around and looking at an amazing diversity of plants, all the way up to octogenarians who will also delight in the place. Often there's memories here. Having been around for 220 years means that we are a setting for so many memories that people have of the place.
Are they mostly locals?
A huge number of locals will be here daily. And it's great to sort of wave at somebody who is coming in on their morning walk and often their afternoon walk as well. Because these are the people actually who give us the best insight into what we might be doing wrong. Because we do need to constantly correct ourselves and adjust things.
What do you think attracts visitors to the gardens here?
I think it is that sheer mix that you can come as a family, and if those in the group are fascinated about plants, there's a label on every single plant. So you don't have to ask somebody or wonder what it is. You just read the label. Whilst the other people in the group may be interested in bird watching or, you know, lying on the grass, enjoying a walk, it does mean there's a diversity of things for people to do.
It's very family friendly. I've always thought that about the gardens. You can walk on the grass. You go to lots of other places. You're told to stay off the grass. You can see for miles. You've got the beautiful glass houses. Surely that attracts lots of people.
Well, one of the great benefits of that, it doesn't matter if it's raining or, you know, there are showers around. You can pop into the glass houses every time there's a shower of rain and back out when the sun comes out. So you do have that diversity of indoor and outdoor spaces.
Mm. What numbers would you be getting per year now?
We are nudging well over 500,000, about 600,000 visitors a year. Mm. We have a connection now through to the cemetery, and the Glasnevin Cemetery, again, is a great place to visit deceased members of your family. And also that brings a sort of edge of cheer, really, that you can then visit the gardens. And many of the people buried there, especially the locals, will have long family connections to the gardens as well. So it's a pleasant place to remember past relatives.
You've been here for many years now. What has changed?
Gosh, that's always difficult. You know, sometimes one of the great analogies is the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland, who has to run as fast as she can to stay in the same place, because that is what happens in any garden. There is this life of little annual plants. There's the edging of the grass paths, edging of the beds, sowing of seeds, the removal of dead plants and dead inflorescences. So there's a constant cycle of change. And essentially, at the end of the year, it looks the same. And that is the important thing. There's a lot of work goes into keeping the place looking the same. But we've added, constantly adding new stuff to the gardens. And that's another great pleasure.
Yeah, I know, because we're standing here underneath the strawberry tree, the tree that was actually planted by our president, Michael D. Higgins, many, many years ago. So there is change taking place, even though it is the same. And we're looking at the glasshouses, the Turner glasshouses. They are spectacular. And they've recently been renovated.
When you look at them now, yes, it does look like they've been recently renovated, but actually that is now nearly 30 years ago.
Really?
And it's not had a single touch of paint put back on it. I think we power hosed it just once many years back. It's an astonishing demonstration, really, of the quality of the rebuild and restoration that was undertaken by the Office of Public Works. So the architects, Kieran O'Connor especially, you know, he led that restoration, and it was highly innovative at the time. So the technology that went into it alone is demonstrated. Here we are 30 years later, and it looks pristine, like a wedding cake.
I believe the original glasshouse there, that opened when Queen Victoria came to Dublin. I think that was 1849. So you're talking nearly 200 years now.
Yes, and you know, there's a wonderful engraving, and it's of the carriage carrying the Queen in front of the curvilinear range. But what you can't see there is that the director of the time, David Moore, had to jog, running along beside the carriage, being drawn by a horse. He was jogging along and explaining to the Queen the technology involved, because this was a leading ironsmith. Turner was one of Europe's great fabricators of iron, almost unmatched across the kingdom. And he was building glasshouses across not only Britain, but France, Germany. He was exporting these glasshouses, all from Dublin.
Going back to the award then, Matthew, what will it mean to you and the gardens?
I think one of the extraordinary things you'll often hear people say is, oh, yes, no, I live locally, but I haven't been to the gardens for years, not since I was a child. So there's always people who have been dragged along here in their youth and perhaps have put it back on the shelf for too many years to think about, well, we must go down to the garden. So I hope a lot more people think, blimey, you know, we have got the best botanic gardens in Europe on our doorstep. Let us go and visit it again. And I think it's a normal problem, actually. In your own city, you don't go and see the tourist attractions because you know they're always going to be there. And we've been here a very long time, but we would welcome anyone to come and take a fresh visit.
And of course, you have lots of events taking place here in the gardens, especially this week because it's Heritage Week.
Yes, and this year the guides at the National Botanic Gardens have been collating stories from the gardens. They put out a call to all our visitors, our staff as well, asking them for particular anecdotes and tales about the gardens. They've collected them and they'll all be exhibited in the visitor centre during this week.
So now is the ideal time to visit the Botanic Gardens.
It's the perfect moment. And always remember, taking a guided tour here is also eye-opening for people who have visited the gardens regularly but never taken a tour with one of our guides. You will be flabbergasted at the stories you'll hear.
And it's free, so you heard about it here. Go along to the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. I guarantee you'll enjoy yourself. Now, just before we go, I want to say a very special thank you and good luck to Daniel Keating, who was our broadcast coordinator. He's leaving RTE. He's got a new job. So good luck to you, Daniel. And I want to say a very happy birthday to Niall Hatch's mammy. It's her birthday today. Don't forget to visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.